Good evening, everyone. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this public lecture. My name is Bob Buckle. I'm Pro Vice Chancellor and Dean of the Faculty of Commerce and Administration at Victoria University. 2008 is the 50th anniversary of a paper which might have at first appearance seemed rather innocuous. The outcome of that paper was taken up by economists, certainly in the United States, and subsequent two Nobel Prize winners referred to the relationship in that paper as the Phillips curve. This work was the work of Bill Phillips, a New Zealander, who was hardly known in New Zealand at the time and really was not well known and probably not that well known today. He was an extraordinary New Zealander. That piece of work is really just one small piece of the magnificent contributions that Bill Phillips made to economics. And to give us an insight into the life of this extraordinary New Zealander, I have the great pleasure in being able to introduce this evening Dr. Alan Bollard. As most of you are aware, Dr. Alan Bollard is Governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. He has been Secretary of the Treasury, Chairman of the New Zealand Commerce Commission, Director of the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research. He has also worked in a variety of positions overseas as an economist, including in the Pacific region. And in going through this presentation tonight, you might reflect at the end on his role of Governor of the Reserve Bank and responsible for monetary policy, the link that his thinking might have to the work of Bill Phillips. So without any further comments, I'll give you my pleasure to introduce Alan Bollard. Alan will be prepared to take questions at the end of the presentation, and I look forward to the presentation and Alan taking questions from you. Before we start, could I just remind anyone, if you do have cell phones, perhaps just check that they are off now. Thank you very much, Alan.
If you go to Napier and you walk through the sunken gardens there, you can see a water wheel. It's nearly 100 years old and it still works and the water trickles over it and it goes round and round. It was originally built by a very clever, innovative pioneer farmer in Southern Hawke's Bay. He used it to power his milk separator on his dairy farm. It was a small farm in the foothills of the Ruahine Ranges, just south of Dannevirke. A small settlement that's called Te Rahunga. The house is still there today. It was a typical turn-of-the-century small New Zealand dairy farm. And just before World War I, Harold Phillips and his wife Edith Phillips started a family there. And at that point, Harold converted this water wheel so that it would generate electricity for the house, so they'd have light in the house, and they got electricity long before it had come to the district. Well, as European nations were locked in warfare, 1914, a second child was born to the Phillips family. He was christened Alban in memory of the first Christian martyr, and he was baptised, the first child to be baptised, in a little wooden church called St Alban's, which was built on land donated by the parents on the corner of their farm, and that's still there today. Alban, as the family calls him still, but Bill, as we economists call him, grew up in a God-fearing, hard-working family, a hard childhood in some respects, but idyllic in other ways. The children were expected to help the father run the farm. They helped with milking and they helped with haymaking and other chores. They had to go off to primary school a couple of miles away, and to get there, if they were lucky, they might get a ride in the milk cart. And sometimes coming back, they'd come back on horseback. Otherwise, they just had to walk. Alban, Bill and his older brother used to roam the farm, getting up to all sorts of things. And they were introduced by their father to a technical sort of way of life early on. And their sister remembers them building all sorts of things, building crystal radios, building zoetopes. They built a mechanical shooting gallery. They built their own toys. They built their own occupations. But it wasn't just working with the hands. The boys learnt the piano. And later on, Bill taught himself the violin as well. But very importantly, the family, the two boys, and later on two younger girls, were able to read at night in bed. And this was a big luxury compared to anyone else in the district, because they had electricity and they did read very widely. And the family remembers that at a certain time the father would call out, "It's lights out." Then they'd hear a clatter as he picked up a winch beside the bed and fitted it into a cog in the ceiling and wound that around. And then there were the noise of wires and chains going outside the building and along the dike up towards where the wheel was, and then gradually that would trip a gate and the water would flow around the wheel and the lights would start to fade. Bill and his brother and sisters went to Dannyburgh High School. This was 9 miles away, and to get there they had to set off, then bike to the railway station, then catch a train, and then end up going by foot. 9 miles, and it took a long time. As far as he was concerned, for Bill, this was time wasted, and he very quickly found ways around it. He built himself a frame on his bicycle so he could read as he cycled into that Hawke's Bay window. And when he was aged only 14, he bought from one of the neighbours, for £5, a run-down old truck with a tray, and he rebuilt the truck aged 14, and still aged 14. He drove himself and the other neighbourhood children to school, parking carefully around the corner and down the road somewhere. Well, clearly he was a talented person, even at an early age. But by 1929, the Depression had hit, and that was bad news for this farm as commodity prices fell. And even though in many ways it was a modern, innovative farm, later to become a stud farm, they couldn't afford to keep Bill at school, and therefore he couldn't finish his schooling, and therefore there was no way he was going to get to university. So aged 17, he went out, sorry, aged 15, he left school and he went out and joined the Public Works Department. He drove his motorbike to Waikaremoana, Tuai, and helped work on the Tuai electric power station building that was going on there. But he was already showing that he was a little bit unusual and very innovative and quite entrepreneurial. He'd been very interested in the talkies that were just coming out at that time. And at Tuai, Waikaremoana, he set up a small picture theatre showing talkies and charged people for entrance. Here he is with his picture theatre in 1932. His sister also records that he, unusually for the members of the Public Works Department camp at Waikaremoana, Bill had gone off with his favourite encyclopaedia set of world religions and world philosophies, which he read in the evening while he was there. He was clearly learning about the world, and he very quickly wanted to sample the world as well. And like some New Zealanders today, he went off to Australia first of all. And he packed his swag and he packed his fiddle, and he travelled around on slow freight trains out into the outback looking for interesting jobs and interesting experiences. And he worked there in construction. He worked as a banana picker. He worked at one stage in a gold mine. He actually worked as a crocodile hunter for a while there. But he was never happy just to do those sort of physical jobs. He was learning the whole time. And he records that he enrolled in a correspondence course to learn more about electrical engineering, which proved very important for him. He said later he learned his first differential equations lying in the sun at Nautbach Gold Mine. And then he kept up that learning as he travelled around the world, because he wasn't happy with just learning about Australia. He wanted to get into China and go around East Asia. And in 1937, he got passage aboard a Japanese ship that was bound for China. It was bound for Shanghai. Unfortunately for Bill, as it got offshore, the Manchurian invasion by the Japanese broke out, and the Japanese ship changed course for Yokohama, and Bill found himself in Japan. He travelled through southern Japan. He travelled down to Hiroshima, where he was temporarily arrested for going around with a camera taking pictures, and the Japanese were worried that he was a spy. But he got out of that, and he continued travelling around Japan, and he travelled to Korea. Then eventually he did get to Manchuria in China and to Harbin. And he recorded that as he went round, Japanese Secret Service was tracking him round as they went, because they were quite suspicious of what he was doing. It just wasn't the sort of thing that young New Zealanders did in those days. But Bill continued on, and he got onto the Trans-Siberian Express and slowly made his way across the Soviet Union. He got off at various places and tried to get casual jobs. He was unsuccessful, and he recorded later that all the jobs seemed to have gone to political prisoners. But it was a very difficult time in Soviet Russia, and he travelled through from Moscow, then to Poland, and then through Nazi Germany until he got to London. In London, he got a serious job working in engineering and working for electricity companies, and he continued his correspondence course and eventually graduated with a diploma in electrical engineering with the Institute of Electrical Engineers there. But as you know, things were getting very difficult around Europe, and 1939 war broke out. Bill enlisted in the Royal Air Force, and he was trained as an engineer there, and with the rank of flying officer, he was sent to Singapore to maintain the small fleet of RAF fighters there. They were Buffalo Brewster RAF fighters. They were oldish planes, but apparently the only serious fighters that were there to help stem the Japanese threat, as it became clear when the Japanese entered the war and started moving down the Malayan Peninsula. Bill readapted those planes while he was there. They were ones that had originally been designed with four firing points. They only had two out of the wings. And he adapted the fuselages to allow two extra machine guns to fire through the propellers, something that they hadn't managed to do at the base. Those planes were very important in the defence of Singapore, though, as we know, they were ultimately unsuccessful. The Japanese, by 1942, had swept down the peninsula, bombing very heavily, and the order came to evacuate Singapore. Bill was on the last civilian ship out of Singapore. It's the Empire Star, and the Empire Star had a complement of 2,000 soldiers and women and children from the Singapore garrison, and they were very, very crowded. As they left Singapore and headed for Java, they came under serious attack from the Japanese fighters and then later Japanese bombers. They were attacked for some hours and suffered quite a lot of damage. You can see here some of that going on. The ship, on the ship, on the boat deck, Bill Phillips is mentioned in dispatches as helping build some heavy engineering mountings that they could put machine guns in to use as sort of rough anti-aircraft guns, which he then helped man, and they helped beat off this attack. Bill received later the MBE for doing that. They got and limped into Java, then Batavia, and which was then under Dutch control, and Bill and some of his mates made their way across the island to the south coast. They could see, as happened a couple of days later, that the Dutch were forced into surrendering as well when the Japanese invaded. While he was living in a secret, hidden camp with a couple of his mates, they made plans to build a boat to sail to Australia, as only Bill Phillips would be able to do. To do that, they got hold of an old bus body and turned it upside down and started rebuilding it as a boat hull. Unfortunately, they got some way in this endeavour and were going back to their base camp one day and bumped into the Japanese patrol and were arrested. And for Bill and his colleagues, the rest of the war was a terrible one because they were put in a prisoner of war camp in Bandung in Java and had a terrible time with the brutality of that camp, the awful conditions, and the inadequate food and the complete lack of medicines there. Discipline was brutal. It was a horrible lifestyle, and he was there for 3 years. Many men died in terrible conditions there. If you're interested in this, you can read about it in Laurens van der Post's book, Night of the New Moon, which is set in that camp. And in that book, he talks about a strange New Zealand officer who was engaged in various exploits there. The picture is a poster of a film well known to New Zealanders. It's Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. It's the film of that book by Laurens van der Post. It also had a certain notoriety in legal tax circles. It was shot in Rarotonga and also in Mount Eden Prison in Auckland, starred Tom Conti and David Bowie. The conditions were terrible in this camp and many people died. Bill afterwards said that the smaller ones, and he was a very short man, survived on the inadequate rice rations, and the taller men tended to die of malnutrition. But despite those awful conditions, Bill was never idle there, and he was one of the prisoners who organised lessons and courses and classes to keep people's mind going. And he learnt in the camp himself Mandarin and Russian, and he never lost those languages. He also was involved in various inventions. It's recorded that he helped build some immersion heaters for troops who wanted to make cups of tea, and the Japanese apparently were quite confused and surprised why at 10 o'clock on the dot every night the lights in the camp all dimmed as everybody used Bill's immersion heaters to make their cups of tea. He is recorded in van der Post's book as being involved in a dangerous mission to get into Japanese commandant's office, steal parts from the Japanese commandant's radio, take them away and build them into a new radio. In fact, Bill built two new radios, clandestine radios, in the camp. One was embedded in under some tiles in the kitchen that he could only get at by long bicycle spokes that he used to control it. Another was built into a clog, a wooden clog, and worn by prisoners. And whenever there was a danger of capture or of that showing up, a prisoner would put those on and walk around. Now, I regret to say this is a photo from the Australian War Memorial Museum in Canberra labelled Work of an Australian Prisoner of War in a Java Camp. And you must draw your own conclusions. As the war fortunes turned against the Japanese, the prisoners became very worried because they knew that orders had gone out to slaughter the prisoners before liberation. And indeed, in Bill's camp, they were involved in digging mass graves in preparation for this. You can imagine their reactions when they got news from Bill, who had been listening under blankets lying on his bunk, and had managed to pick up from a crackly radio station in India news about the atom bomb at Hiroshima. And it was great news as far as the prisoners were concerned. They were saved, and they were liberated quite shortly after that. Bill was repatriated to New Zealand. His family report themselves as being shocked seeing him when he came back, and he was quite unable to eat normally because he was just so malnourished and thin. He'd lost weight, his health was permanently affected, and he was nicotine addicted, like a lot of prisoners were as well. He did get a New Zealand serviceman's grant. It was something put in place by Peter Fraser's government to help reward New Zealand service people whose education or that time of life had been really messed up by the war. And Bill chose to go back to London, to the London School of Economics, to do a degree. But interestingly, he chose to do a sociology degree. We don't know why, other than we can suppose that he was just trying to make some sense of all the war camp and East Asian experiences he'd had and wanted to understand things better. But as it turned out, he didn't enjoy his sociology degree. He described sociology as a mixture of ethics, social statistics, and sort of pseudoscience. And in the end, he scraped through with a BSc pass. It sounds like a compassionate pass. It was recorded. He couldn't sit still through an exam because of his nicotine addiction. And he had quite a tough time getting through. But he did do some stage one economics at the time. And in a famous scene recorded in his autobiography, Sir Lionel Robbins, the chairman of the economics department of the London School of Economics, records being accosted in the foyer of the LSE school by a madman with a strange New Zealand accent who was waving blueprints under his nose and claiming that he could show things in economics that the lecturers had been unable to do. Because Bill, with his very unusual background, his genius of a mind and his engineering approach, had sat there through these economics lectures and listened to some of the arguments about classical economics, the whole economy and how it all moves together, and then he had heard the arguments of Maynard Keynes that were still floating around the place at this stage about whether or not some parts of it were quite sticky and whether there could be a role for government to help it. And he'd put all these in his mind into a very engineering sort of framework and said, well, if you build a model, you can show how all these things work and you can show these arguments going on and you can help clarify them. And we do owe it to Sir Lionel Robbins, who for all his sort of stuck-upness and stiffness was clever enough to realise an unusual talent, and he introduced Bill Phillips to James Mead, later Sir James Mead, later Nobel Prize winner, who, when he won the Nobel Prize, said he owed more to Bill Phillips than to anybody else. And they became friends. James Mead was an unusual English gentleman, and unusual in the way that Bill Phillips liked. And these two would talk happily about going fishing together. Nothing unusual about that. But they were looking for the optimal cliff face with the optimal elevation, the optimal updraft to allow them to go fishing by kite. It was that sort of relationship. James Mead in his memoirs talks about Phillips quite a lot, and he afterwards records the time a little later on when Bill was visiting him at home and James Mead was complaining about his piano, which had gone out of tune. "I'll fix it," said Bill, and he went out to get the tools from his car. And when he came back, James said, "Have you tuned a piano much before?" And Bill said, "No, but it's just a matter of working from first principles." And he worked away with his car tools and he tuned the piano. At another time, James Mead tells of the surprise around the LSE common room when this very quiet New Zealander mildly put up his head one morning and said, "Well, would you believe it? Look what they're talking about in Pravda today." And he would read Pravda like a whole lot of other publications that he would read quietly without telling anybody about it. James Mead convinced the London School of Economics to give a small grant to build a prototype. And together with a colleague, Walter Newland, he built a small model of the economy. Economic modelling had gone through some changes during the war. I mean, you'd had the Soviets, for example, were developing the whole area of cybernetics because they wanted to control an economy through central planning, and that required massive detail of statistics and some calculation as well. In the States, you had people like Vasily Leontief, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on what we call input-output mapping. And that was really getting a picture of the economy and showing what is produced where in that economy, where it is sold to, what it becomes an input to, and what is produced further downstream in that economy, what is imported and exported. And he had done that in quite a major way for the United States and to some extent for Britain. And it was that sort of framework that the Bomber Command used, the Allied Bomber Command used in bombing the German Empire during the war and are trying to work out how best you killed off an economy, what were the crucial key bottleneck points in it. And it was that area of economics that they used in trying to argue about should you bomb armaments factories in cities or should you bomb railway junctions. And if you're going to bomb armaments factories, do you bomb the end product or do you bomb the ball bearing factory? That's what they decided to do. And if you're bombing railway lines, do you bomb the platforms, the junctions or the bridges? The junctions, as it turns out. So they were already applying that sort of thinking to an economy. And indeed, after the war, immediately after the war, you see J.K. Galbraith, famous economist, and one of Bill Phillips' later colleagues, Nicky Kaldor, a Hungarian economist who went to the London School of Economics. They're in Berlin for the Strategic Bombing Command, trying to work out what worked and what didn't. In the end, they conclude a lot of it didn't because the bombs were so inaccurate. But the principle was there anyway. Now the war's over, and they're trying to... You get these people trying to work out, well, we worked out how to destroy an economy. Can we use similar techniques on how to rebuild an economy? And indeed, it's quite a crucial exercise because the whole job of getting an economy off a war footing onto a consumer footing, it's very, very difficult. There's huge pent-up demand for stuff, but in Britain, the economy is in a terrible shape, actually worse than during the war. 1947, you have a terrible winter, which kills off a lot of the crops. You have government reintroducing rationing of bread and potatoes. In the war, bread and potatoes were never rationed. It got much worse after the war. People are going hungry. There's now been some government documents come to light, top secret then, which make plans to forcibly mobilise the labour force of the country and move them by force out into the fields to bring in the harvest if that's necessary. That's never been done in Britain's history, and it shows just how difficult things were. The Americans were making things worse by being very demanding on the lend-lease loans in addition. There was a new Labour government had come in, promising all sorts of things. They were proceeding by nationalising a lot of large industry, but they didn't really have much of an idea about macroeconomic management. And you had the unions who were getting, in some cases, into significant class warfare, and there was rioting and a lot of strikes. After a best part of a year of what he called living on air, Bill Phillips had built the small prototype machine, and in 1949 he took it to a seminar room at the London School of Economics and he demonstrated it. And it was to an audience of, I think there's probably four or five later Nobel Prize winners amongst them. Many of them apparently had come along to have a laugh. They were bowled over by what they saw, by the strange New Zealander with a cigarette either hanging out of his hand or out of his mouth. And all the photographs is one or the other. And he demonstrated how an economy might work by flows of water around this machine. This is a small machine, as you can see. And the seminar was bowled over, and London School of Economics just broke through the sort of normal bureaucratic barriers you might expect at a university, gave Bill Phillips £700 and told him to build a full-scale machine that would represent the British economy. Bill did this, ironically, to help rebuild the British economy. He used war surplus from machines that had been used to wreck the German economy. He went to the bomber scrapyards. He got pumps of landing gear off bomber aircraft. He got perspex for the tanks that he cut out of the windscreen from Lancasters. He presented graphs which ran on little motors along the top, which were out of the windscreen wipers from Lancaster bombers, and he put it all together with rivets and glue and fishing line and clockwork machinery in a Croydon garage. He played around with using treacle and mist to see if that would flow through it, but in the end he decided on cochineal dye and water and represented a full Keynesian classical system on this machine that he built. It looks pretty simple there because he's carefully set it out in a way that is a simple economic system with households and with government and with banks and with an overseas sector. But underneath all that is a lot of complexity. And each of those little white rectangles you can see there is a piece of perspex with a hole cut in it, and that represents an equation. And actually there's nine of them. It's a nine differential equation system. And in 1949, nobody in the world that I can find reference to could solve a nine differential equation system. But Bill Phillips, this strange man from New Zealand without an economics degree, built a machine that could do that. It was calibrated as well, so it was actually representing the British economy. There's little notches cut along it, and he reckoned it was accurate to plus or minus 2% of most of the variables. Actually, it's totally accurate, except for the fact that little globs of water stick through the system, and that does make a bit of a difference. He said it was primarily to demonstrate things, and that's what it turned out to be. But you could also do experiments on it, and you could do tests, and you could prove various economics arguments on it one way or the other. It was, of course, hardwired in a way that modern calculators aren't. You couldn't type in changes to the underlying model. What you could do is pull out those bits of perspex, take them to your workbench, get a hacksaw and cut a new slit in them, which would represent a new estimated equation. You had to do it very carefully. It had to be all smoothed off because there's a little brass runner that has to run up and down those moving things, because as you move anything in that system, for example, you might want to increase a tax rate or spend more from government or do some monetary policy movements, as you do each of those, you'll move a little gate which will mean more or less water flowing into one of the tanks, which will mean the float in that tank will go up or down a little, which will pull on some strings around some circles which are connected in turn to all the other ones, and they will all over time move, adjust and readjust. And then, like Charles Babbage, he was impatient at the thought that somebody might do an experiment and then make a mistake printing it out. So he tied the whole thing together up to the top to two bits of graph paper where you put four pins and holders, set a machine going, and the holders print out the effects of your experiment as you go on. They go from one steady state, then they do a lot of turbulence, and then they go to a new steady state. That transition path is something that economists have managed to do only a couple of decades ago, probably much later than this. So it's very sophisticated in the way that it can treat those sort of experiments and then print out. When you look at the actual model, it's even more complex. And there's parts to it that represent things that hadn't actually been invented in real life yet. But Phillips took the view that, well, why wouldn't you have a situation whereby you've got a banking system, you get more money from overseas. If you're going to bring that in, you could do it with a fixed or not fixed money supply. You could move this interest rate around. Now, moving interest rates around like that is something, in the way that he proposes, is something that's very redolent of modern monetary policy. If you're looking at the exporting and importing sector, you can bring overseas funds into the machine. When you do that, you can do it in a number of different ways. One of them is to allow a floating exchange rate. There weren't floating exchange rates in 1949. They hadn't been invented yet. But with his completely classical mind, empty of a lot of things that economists might otherwise have put into it, he was able to say, well, why wouldn't you have that? And that's one reason why today we still find this machine is very useful for demonstrating things. Well, it captured the public imagination in Britain and more widely. Here's a cartoon out of Punch magazine by Emmett. And the cartoonist had a field day. The Punch magazine, this particular article, says this is a wonderful machine. Britain needs an installation in every town hall, every recreation ground, every railway station, and every dog track. And we see references right through the last 50 years to this. So last year, Terry Pratchett published a book called, called Making Money. And in that, he's got a blooper analogy machine, and he makes it very clear that this is indeed the Phillips hydraulic machine that he's talking about. The machine was very popular for demonstration purposes, and Phillips made up to a dozen, and they were sold for £1,000 or £2,000, so serious pieces of work. They went to mainly universities around the world, but also to some central banks, to some companies, and to some other organisations as well. His American agent, a famous economist himself called Abel Lerner, christened it the MONIAC machine, the Monetary National Income Automatic Computer. And that was because at the same time you had the ENIAC machine in the States and John von Neumann's machine for Los Alamos, which was being unkindly referred to as the MANIAC machine. London School of Economics realised they had quite an unusual person on their hand, and with imperial grandeur, they wrote a letter to the New Zealand government informing them that this fellow Phillips showed unusual promise and he must be released from his bond to go back to New Zealand because they wished to keep hold of him. And that was agreed by the New Zealand government. And within a year or two, Bill Phillips had been appointed to a staff position. He was working within a few years on his PhD. He was soon made a lecturer. With only 3 years later, he was a reader, associate professor, the year that he married a New Zealander, Velda, in London. And by 1958, this unusual New Zealander without a proper undergraduate degree was a professor at the London School of Economics. The expositional use of this machine continued. The second machine that Bill built was a mirror image of the first, and it's the one on the right there. And he would call it, he called the first one the British economy and the other one the rest of the world or the US economy or something like that. It became very popular with James Mead, the Nobel Prize winner, and his friend who's shown in this picture in the 1950s at London School of Economics. He had joined the two machines together, joined the pipes out of one into the other, so they were effectively exchanging money and traded goods. And he would call up from the audience a couple of students to play the roles of the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Minister, the Governor of the Bank of England on one machine, and then on the other, say, the Chairman of the Federal Reserve and the Secretary of the US Treasury, to play around with the fiscal policy and monetary policy levers and see how they could do the best for their country. And Mead records this usually ended up with water all over the floor, but it was quite an instructive sort of exercise. And indeed, Mead later got his Nobel Prize for modelling trade theory. And we find amongst the people who worked on the American machine as students of James Mead, Paul Volcker, later chairman of the Federal Reserve, and people like Richard Cooper, later Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the US. So I think one can assume this was pretty influential in all of this. The machine on the right-hand side there is now in London Science Museum, where you can see it sitting opposite Babbage's big difference engine. The machine on the left-hand side was donated by the London School of Economics to us in New Zealand. We had to raise a lot of money some 10, 15 years ago to get it, bring it back to New Zealand, and at which point we offered it to the Te Papa Museum. Sadly, they weren't interested in that. It's the world's first economic computer, as far as we know. So we plumbed it into the entrance of the Institute of Economic Research. Recently, they have generously lent it to the Reserve Bank, which has a small museum. And we do have one big advantage, which is that we have a money machine engineer professional on staff. So he's had an interesting time, and it's working very well now. And you're all very welcome to come in and see it, those of you who haven't seen our museum, which has got your economy and ways of looking about your economy in it. In the meantime, ENIAC, the electronic computer, was in development, and with the Manhattan Project, there was a lot going on in electronics in the States. And I think we can assume that Bill was starting to see that from a computational point of view, the MONIAC machine was looking like a white elephant. And as he did so often in his life, he moved on. He moved on to other areas. It's the 1950s. It's another turbulent period. Europe's gradually recovering, but we've got the Korean War. We've got still a lot of issues around Eastern European economies and the Iron Curtain, McCarthyism in the United States, new independence movements breaking away from the old British Empire all over the world. The British economy still very weak, the pound sterling struggling, class struggle going on, a lot of volatility. 1955, there's a new Conservative government this time. Sir Anthony Eden is Prime Minister. A year later, together with France, Britain invades the Suez Canal, and we have this whole Suez Canal, Suez crisis debacle. It's made worse by the fact the same year the Hungarian uprising takes place and the Soviets respond very heavily and invade Hungary. And you need to remember that there's a number of quite famous Hungarian economists at the London School of Economics, colleagues of Bill Phillips. Bill is sitting there trying to work out how to stabilise an economy given all these shocks that are going on. And he's doing that with, again, his engineer's mind. And in 1954, he works out a mathematical model that can show how an economy can cycle as it gets hit by these shocks. And he says he thinks that governments could find some way of delivering counter-shocks to try and help stabilise it. But it's a problem because the only model he can deal with has to be a very, very simple single-time model. It has to be very simple because he's trying to calculate it all by hand. And that very much limits it all. And so he's saying something and publishing in 1954 an article that shows how this might work and how a government might dampen it through fiscal and monetary policy. But it's not a real model. He knows that. He just hasn't got the computing power to do anything with it. Then a couple of years later, he moves out further and starts to design, in mathematics, a more realistic model. This is a dynamic model. It moves through time and things change and prices change and interest rates change. And this is the sort of model that economists today would find much more credible. But it's too complicated to calculate with the resources that are on hand. Because what you're seeing at this stage amongst economists is we are starting to see big economic models being built. They're in the United States, particularly built by the Cowles Commission. They talk about having these things calculated by their computers. But what they mean is they've got a room of mainly middle-aged ladies with mechanical calculators and graph paper, and they're doing tedious calculation after calculation, and they're finding shortcut ways of roughly estimating and recalculating and inverting matrices and things like that and getting approximate results, which they then have to go through all over again to check. So it's pretty unsophisticated sort of calculation that's there. Bill Phillips is, in one of his papers, speculating at this stage that if you had such a thing as an electrical analog computer, you could be putting basically voltage shocks through it to carry out experiments and test sort of responses, which you might see coming through in cycles on some sort of oscilloscope. He's thinking in those sort of terms. But he gets onto something better. In Britain, during the war, a lot of the computing power has been focused around the deciphering and signalling establishments like we know about in Bletchley Park. And I'm sure some of you have either read Robert Harris's novels or seen Mick Jagger's film about the Enigma machine. The Bletchley Park did develop some mechanical calculating machines called bombs. Actually, interestingly, they've all been bought up and refurbished by Mick Jagger and another London School of Economics alumni. Well, not a graduate because he dropped out, but an entrant anyway. And he was interested in these for the reason that they had enough calculating power to enable the British to crack those German signalling codes during the war. But after the war, the British Secret Service swept in and put veils over all the computing equipment and sent them off to places like Cheltenham, the spy agency there. This was in sharp contrast to what happened in the States, where they went to universities and it was all very open. And the results are clear in history that Britain immediately lost its computing lead and the States never looked back. At Bletchley Park, there'd been a very unusual mathematician called Alan Turing, again very famous. And after the war, he designed, in principle, a new automatic computer he called the ACE machine. And he went to Manchester hoping to build it, but as part of another project there. Unfortunately, he was, a little while after that, exposed as a practicing homosexual by the British establishment, forced into chemical castration, and shortly after that committed suicide. The work, however, was taken on by Manchester University, and Manchester was one place where they did work away at computers. They built an ACE computer, and then eventually out of that they derived Britain's first digital computer of any size, the Juice Machine. And the Juice Machine, was in Manchester, but also there was a copy held by one of the British Post Office's establishments, the National Physical Laboratory outside London. And Bill Phillips had another friend, another strange friend, Richard Tizard, who was very keen, worked at the NPL and was very keen on computing. And one day, in a weekend, Bill persuaded Richard Tizard to let him into the NPL laboratories and to play with this machine. And he took in with him his new, bigger mathematical model. And he managed to solve it on this electronic machine. Now, in some ways, we might think that could have been the first, certainly the first example of optimal control theory being used in this way, possibly the first dynamic economic simulation of this sort done on electric computer, on electronic computer. What was he doing? Well, here's what he wrote up as results and published them in Economica and what they showed. This is just one of them, but for example, he's saying, well, let's assume you've got an economy which is hit by a nasty shock. In Britain, it's another pound sterling. It's a very big strike. Its terms of trade drop right out. And there's a few other crises all at once. And it leads to that very deep cycle you can see, which in his numbers mean that after a year, you've got a fall off in GDP of about 6%, a real nasty shock. What happens if you leave the economy to recover itself? It cycles, and very gradually, but only after, in this case, about 8 years, recovers, but never recovers its original position. So it leaves an economy that's weaker than it was before. What could government do about this? Well, he, in his model, has got government spending as an instrument. And he says, well, if you can time it properly, you can do things to lessen that initial shock. Look at two of his experiments up there. And certainly to even it out and get it back to equilibrium much sooner. But he does warn us all. He says, to do this properly would be extremely intricate. You need to minimise delays, you need to adjust all the time, you need to take on board new information as you learn it. You'd need to work out some rules for doing this, and he works out some engineer's rules and applies them. Interestingly, one of them is what we call a levels rule, and one of them is a momentum rule. They determine how big a force you put in place to hit that negative force, how big a positive force you put in place. And today, we find that we are using rules that are the same. Our levels rule is called the Taylor rule. It's a famous monetary policy rule which says how much should you move an interest rate by under certain circumstances. Our other rule is a momentum rule, just like Phillips, proposed by an American academic, Carl Walsh, who did some of his thinking in New Zealand, and it's called the Walsh momentum rule. We use that too. It's just like the rules that Phillips is proposing here. He also wisely said, be careful, bad policy can make it worse. And that's something that we know now as well. He talked about what happens if the business sector or people know you're going to do this. That can make a difference as well. If you've got expectations that they're going to do this, people will prejudge and move in different ways. And that was quite a sophisticated thought at that time, one that was later picked up by several other economists who in turn won Nobel Prizes for their foresight on that too. But what we end up is something which was using government expenditure, but Phillips says in his article, you could do this with monetary policy as well. And indeed, in principle, at a simple level, it's what we are doing now with monetary policy. A little bit later on, the DSIR in Britain very worried about this Juice machine and what it was doing and what people like Tizard were doing on it, carried out a very critical report on its usage. And we find, interestingly, a footnote in that says, we note Mr. Phillips' work on this machine. We do not understand at this stage whether Mr. Phillips' work on the analogue computer will prove to be useful or will prove to be a menace to society. Useful, I think, is the answer. Well, I think. But Phillips, once again, was moving on. In these sort of models, he was worried about the fact that he couldn't clearly find a useful relationship that put in prices in a way that would take account of what was going on, and prices were clearly very important in these economies. He was speculating that you could see inflation that was probably going to be proportional to how hot the economy would be, but that was just news. That was speculation and new thinking amongst economists. In 1958, one of his colleagues at London School of Economics showed him a set of data that related to the British labour market. It was actually unemployment numbers and British wages for a very long, unusually long time period, nearly 100 years, back into the 1860s. And Bill Phillips took this home and what he called a wet weekend's work. You can see his actual working in the top part of that slide. He carried out a simple correlation on some of the data and played around with some of the rest of it, probably using one of those plastic curved rulers from the look of his working. And it looked that he seemed to have quite a robust relationship. And he wrote this up and showed some of his colleagues. Now, what he had in one sense was a labour market relationship that looked quite interesting, but in another sense was... It appeared to open that Pandora's box that economists had been banging up against for some time, which was finding a durable relationship between the real economy, how much we all produce, goods and services and so on, and the money economy, prices, wages, interest rates, all that side. And this looked like it really was a relationship that would work between those two. And when he showed it to his colleagues, they were very excited about it. One of them sent it to another colleague who was happened to be the editor of the Economica journal, and by the following day that person had decided he would publish it. That's simply not how things happen these days. Bill had gone off in the meantime on a sabbatical to the University of Melbourne and was quite unprepared for when this paper was published and it burst onto the academic and policy scene. In the policy scene, things were changing again in the 1950s. The wartime planners were being replaced by professional economists. They were forecasters. And there were a new breed of macroeconomists who were there thinking about ways to help an economy work better, advising ministers who themselves were pretty interested in getting more out of an economy. And they were inclined to grab at this relationship and interpret it as offering a menu of options. It's laid out there on that curved line. In sort of simple terms, you could either be a Tory and worker and say, well, you've got to run an economy around the bottom half of that graph. It's got to be one where there is very limited inflation. That means pound sterling will hold up and our reserves will stay in place, even though you mightn't be growing that fast. On the other hand, the sort of new Labour view would be a go-for-growth view. That was the top half. And that would say, well, we can afford to allow some inflation. We don't worry so much about that if we get people into jobs and there's more growth and the economy grows faster. Now, Phillips, when he saw this happening, a number of times warns against it and says he's quite uneasy about this work being interpreted in this sort of way. But in a way, the cat was out of the bag. And there was consistent misinterpretation of whether this allowed an economy to fine-tune and pick out a particular position and position itself on that. Jim Callaghan, later British Chancellor of the Exchequer, early 1960s in one of his budgets, quotes the Phillips curve as being a justification for extra expansionary spending to try and make the economy grow faster. And as you can see on this slide, it's Newsweek, early 1960s. The media went to town and interpreted it their own way as well. Amongst academics, it kindled a huge debate. At sort of the most extreme interpretation, it was really a Keynesian interpretation versus what became to be known as a monetarist interpretation. This paper became one of the most cited, and it became even more acute in the 1960s and early 70s when one started to see a real pickup in inflation and a pickup in unemployment as well. And there's a huge amount of work done on this. Milton Friedman early on is very sniffy about this, and later on he comes out more arguing quite strongly against it, saying, no, you don't have this sort of range of options, because if you have a government that tries to run at a higher inflation rate, all that will happen is that business people and unionists will see this happening and they'll demand higher prices and they'll demand higher wages as a result, and they'll build in that inflation more and more until you get a hyperinflation situation. He said, well, it might run on the short run, but that's all. It won't run for long. That argument has gone on and on and on. It's reached some sort of uneasy truce now today. From our point of view, central banks like ours do use in their model, in their forecasting model, we tend to have something like an expectations augmented Phillips curve. It's a bunch of code that won't mean much to many of you, but it's the Phillips curve relationship that's in there that helps us in our forecasting. Well, in the meantime, Phillips moved on again. It's the 1960s. It's still turbulent. We have the Cuban crisis, assassination of John F. Kennedy. The Vietnam War is hotting up. There's a lot more spending going on to it. That means the American economy is getting overheated. But in addition, it also means students are starting to get revolting. And we hear all about the cobblestones in May 68 in Paris, but actually in London they were onto it earlier. And in 1967, there's major student riots and protests, and they invade the campus of the London School of Economics. Just to make things worse, there's another pound sterling crisis. Bill doesn't like it. He's reacting like you hear a number of prisoners of war or people who had scarred war experiences react. They want to get away from this sort of turbulence. He could see all his savings being eroded from the pound sterling. He didn't like the student actions. He burnt all his papers, except for that little snippet you saw on the previous slide. And he looked to go somewhere and take his family, he now had two girls, to take his family somewhere safe and sound and out of all this turbulence. With his reputation, he received offers from all around the world, and he accepted one in faraway, distant, quiet little Canberra at the Australian National University on condition that he could spend half his time working on what he wanted to work on. And what he wanted to work on, surprisingly, now that he moved on again, was the Chinese economy. He spoke, as you know, Mandarin and Russian. A lot of the source materials are in both those languages. He also actually spoke some Dutch, some German, some Malay as well. But in the late 1960s, China had gone into its cultural revolution. It was an absolute turmoil. And while today there are many, many scholars of China and many economists who study China, it was pretty much unheard of amongst economists at that time to be interested in and think you could study China. We don't know for sure where he was going to get to on that. What's left is his surviving papers. They show that he's getting down to some real basic work team sort of data where he's painfully translating materials that talk about how much rice production and what size paddy field what sort of work team can do. And we do see little bits and pieces where he speculates about if this economy really gets itself organised, how it could grow. Well, that was all out in the future, of course, but it certainly wasn't happening at that stage. But you do have Bill thinking about technologies and the possibility of a real growth takeoff. But by the early 1970s, his health is badly failing. And although he's only in his high 50s, he has a series of strokes. And in 1974, he comes to Auckland with his family. In 1975, he comes into the economics department, a number of us here knew him there, and he wants to teach a course on the Chinese economy. His doctor advises him not to, but he goes ahead anyway. My wife, Jenny Morell, in the audience today was one of his students. I've read one of her essays that's still in his papers that he never got around to marking. But unfortunately, in 1974, he had a final stroke and he died. He was interred in the family grave right back in a little country cemetery outside Dannevirke. And the wheel for Bill Phillips had done a complete rotation. Well, in New Zealand, we like our heroes to be very creative people and very inventive. They've got to know how to use a screwdriver properly. We like them to be practical. We like them to be clever. We love it when they're able to show foreign experts that they're wrong. But we also like them to be unassuming, quiet people as well. And this was Bill. He left the place a much more knowledgeable than when he came into it. Last week, we had 560 economists in Wellington at a Phillips Symposium celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Phillips Curve. I'm sure that Bill would have been the last to think that in 50 years economists would still be there arguing about his ideas. Thank you very much.